It's the corner of America with cozy harbor towns. It's salty air, wicker chairs, and a surf that pounds.
The spirit of Massachusetts is the spirit of America. The spirit of the red, white, and blue. The spirit of Massachusetts is the spirit of America. The spirit that we want to share with you.
For your free Massachusetts vacation kit, call 1-800-624-MASS.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Pretentious Internet Theater. I am your host, Andrew Cook, and I'm so leet. The United States Olympic Curling Team wanted me to join their roster, but as soon as I found out the IOC doesn't offer platinum medals, I refused outright. We are getting ever so closer to our 20th episode of Pretentious Internet Theater. Certainly a milestone, and I decided to share this episode with you elitists who have been listening to this program. It will be taking place live at 4:30 Eastern Daylight Time in Orlando, Florida, at the Orange County Convention Center, Hall D, Room W224, FTH and I, the main events lounge. It'll be taking place immediately following anime music video competition. You remember our last time we did a live show, which was at Mini MegaCon? We had a Hans von Hassel reading by some of you, so I'll offer parts to some of you elitists in the audience, and the plebeians won't even be allowed in the room. We will be reading Quentin Tarantino's Ranma One-Half, a Ranma One-Half fanfic by Stefan Twoflower Gagne. And if I pronounced his name incorrectly, that's how he pronounces his name from now on. That's how leet I am. But present day, present time, let's deal with episode 19. In fact, that reminds me of a quote by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. And if he never pronounced his name that way, it's been changed now. Enjoy when you can, and endure when you must. And with that said, let us proceed. Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents Star Wars vs. Robotech. Author's note, this is a little-known chapter in Star Wars history, one not often talked about, one hidden by the government to this day. This is that story. It has come to be known as Robotech vs. Star Wars, the day the universe stood still. Introduction. The Zentradi were relentless. They continued to attack the mighty SDF-1 without mercy. One of the shoulder-mounted cannon on the mighty ship had been completely destroyed. "We're taking too much damage, Captain," said Sammy, one of the ship's bridge crew members. "We must escape now, or we'll be destroyed." Captain Global pondered this thought. "We can't leave the Earth unprotected," he said, "but to risk killing all 50,000 people on the ship..." Global then decided what he had to do. "I order the hyperspace fold," he said.
"But Captain," said Lisa, the commander of the bridge crew, "remember what happened last time we attempted the fold."
"I know," he replied, "but we have no choice. Commence the fold operation."
The ship began to shake uncontrollably, and the mighty hyperspace fold engines began to turn. The surroundings and Trotty were puzzled. Why had the humans called off their defense systems? Suddenly, a huge green-colored orb collided and engulfed the SDF-1 and any surrounding ships. A large flash immediately followed by a loud hum. After this, the SDF-1 had disappeared. Chapter 1.
"Where were we?" one of the bridge crew asked. "Our position is not in any of the star maps."
"Send a scout out to investigate," Captain Global ordered. "Arm him to his fullest. Give him so much weaponry that nothing out there would even be a threat to him."
Rick Hunter received a message on his door from Captain Globio on the bridge of the SDF-1. It read, "First Lieutenant Hunter, Richard, you have been chosen for a mission of the utmost importance. You must explore the surrounding territory and find out where our craft is and how we get back to Earth. Your craft will be armed with a full array of reflex warheads, and your GU-11 gun pod will also be fully armed. Good luck. You will receive your briefing in the morning. Captain Global.
A mission of utmost importance, eh? Rick said to himself. I probably won't see any action the whole time.
Hours later in the debriefing room, Rick was receiving information in order for his mission to investigate the surrounding space and discovered where the space fold may have taken them. The technical teams loaded up Rick's Veritech with the most top-of-the-line weaponry available to the SDF crew. He was fully armed and fully operational. As Rick looked upon what measures were took to prepare him for anything he may face, he began to wonder if this mission would be as easy as he originally thought. Chapter 2. Rick took off in his Veritech from the mighty Prometheus arm of the SDF-1. His vehicle had a completely new protoculture battery in it. He was given a VF-15 Super Veritech for this mission. It was the best thing that the UN Spacey Corporation had created. The top-mounted cannon on its back with a jet or guardian mode. The missile launcher on each wing, capable of holding 4 reflex missiles. Even had extra thrusters on the back, capable of exiting a planet's atmosphere. This truly was a great ship. He raced through the unknown galaxy at an incredible speed, came upon a white planet, probably snow-covered. Rick decided he should check it out. He flew through the atmosphere and combed the planet's surface. He then saw an incredible sight. A huge gray thing was walking across the planet's surface right towards him. It had 4 huge pillar-like legs. The thing had a very low top speed, but its head had 2 large laser cannons on each side. The walker fired some laser shots at Rick, who, using his amazing speed and maneuverability, avoided the fire barely. This isn't going to be easy, Rick thought. Well, here goes nothing. Chapter 3. Rick prepared to meet this new threat. He armed the GU-11 gun pod and flew in for action. The Veritech performed a 180-degree bank turn. He was now on the side of the walker in the 3 o'clock position. He fired his cannon, letting out 5 rounds and splattering useless slugs across the AT-AT's armor.
Well, this isn't going to work, Rick said to himself. Let's see how you like this. Rick changed to Guardian. Did a sub-aerial turn, skimming the ground. He stopped under the gigantic walker and launched a missile at the AT-AT's belly. There was an explosion, but no damage was done to the walker. The AT-AT driver was annoyed by the craft's futile attempts to destroy him.
Rick didn't understand. How am I going to beat this thing, he thought. Rick then saw the answer.
When the AT-AT walked, it was very shaky. It wobbled as it walked, indicating that this machine had poor balance. Rick changed from Guardian to Battleoid mode. He ran from under the AT-AT, who was trying to stomp on him, and to the walker's side. He pushed on the craft with all his Veritech's power. Finally, the walker began to give way and fall on its side. Rick ran off in his Veritech just in time to escape the gigantic explosion, rocked the earth beneath his Veritech's feet. He changed to fighter mode and flew through the planet's atmosphere, away from the walker. Computer updated, Rick's Nava computer said. Hoth. Oh, okay, so it corrected itself. Chapter 4. Rick's Veritech erupted from the planet, Hoth's atmosphere. His reflex engine roared as he shot through the cosmos. The silence was soon broken when he saw a group of rebel X-Wing fighters attempting to fight off attacking TIE fighters. Rick could clearly see that these rebels, with their highly incapable fighters, were being easily destroyed by the TIEs. He decided it was time to do something. After all, it was the RDF's job, wasn't it? He armed his GU-11 gun pod and flew in from the kill, reflex engine roaring. Rick could tell by the simple design that these TIE fighters were very poorly armored, but had shields capable of absorbing most of the fire from the rebel blasters. To give these ships a warning message to retreat, came from behind one of the TIEs and launched a reflex warhead at it.
What the hell is that? The TIE pilot said. He's got a missile lock on me. Ah!
Pieces of fighter littered the skies. The other fighters, rebel and imperial, were
quite alarmed by this new presence. It looked like the ship the Adak reported being attacked by just minutes before its destruction. It looked nothing like an X-Wing or any other rebel craft. Its weapon systems were also far more powerful than any one-man ship had ever used. Seeing that the TIEs were distracted, the rebels fled, leaving the Imperials alone with a strange ship. The TIEs launched a full strike against Rick. Because of their relatively simple design, Rick could easily tell that these ships did not have the maneuvering capabilities of his more advanced VF-15 Super Veritech had. But what the TIEs lacked in maneuvering and speed, they had firepower. Blaster fire filled the space. Rick used his superior maneuvering skills and speed to his advantage. He did a barrel roll, avoiding the enemy fire, then did an aerial somersault and ended up behind them. Rick then converted to battleoid mode and fired his GU-11 gun pod at one of the fighters. He destroyed one of the fighter's solar panel-like wings. Fighter went out of control and crashed into the one next to it. A fiery explosion rocked the sky. The remaining four fighters turned around to face the fighter, who was now in Guardian mode. One of the TIEs fired at Rick due to its lack that its blaster energy was running out, merely left a burn mark on the ship's wings. The Veritech's chain gun ripped through the ship, destroying its ion engines, killing the pilot and rendering the ship inactive. The last three TIEs attempted to escape, but were destroyed when Rick launched two of its last reflex warheads at them. Rick, in a desperate need of ammo and rest, decided to head back to the SDF-1. When he finally reached it, landed on its Prometheus arm, and downloaded all the information from his ship's computer. He then retired to his quarters for a good meal and a good, long break. Chapter 5. On the bridge of the SDF, a large ship entered radar range. It's huge, almost twice as big as the SDF-1, which is almost a kilometer and one half tall. It was a super-class Imperial Star Destroyer. Sighting of the strange craft, as seen on Hoth and its surrounding galaxy, was reported to Imperial headquarters. They traced it back to this location. Seeing that the ship in which this fighter came back to was quite large, they knew they were right to choose to bring the largest ship they had. The Imperials described the ship as very tall, humanoid-type machine. It was large and had two main docking bays and landing pads. It had two arm-like structures protruding out of its craft's shoulders, which are identified as these strange cannons. The Star Destroyer opened fire on the STF-1, its many blaster cannons spewing hundreds of laser-like particle beams. Captain Global ordered the barrier system to be used, but realizing that it would restrict the operation of the main gun, he retracted that command. Seeing that he had to act fast before the Star Destroyer started causing serious damage to the ship, he ordered the main gun to be fired. The two arm-like structures of the SDF-1 lowered into position. There was a loud, high-pitched hum as the SDF-1's cannon charged up. The Imperials were puzzled, but continued to fire. The main gun was almost fully charged now. Fire! Global ordered. The cannon launched a powerful energy blast. It was too much for the Star Destroyer's shield to take. The armor plates on the Star Destroyer began to peel off. There was a fiery explosion as the ship's core reactor exploded. The ship disintegrated. The ship stopped firing. The target had been destroyed. Commence fold operation, Global ordered. It got us here. Maybe it can take us home. The green orb formed, followed by a flash and a loud hum, and once again, the STF-1 disappeared. The end. Well, that certainly was an interesting tale. I learned a couple of things. I learned that Rick Hunter has the ability to discern good from evil just by looking at the structure of his ship. And I also discerned that the Imperials always like to bring a ship of equal caliber and size to a battle. Certainly, I don't ever recall any of the battles in the Star Wars mythos, maybe in the first 5 minutes of the first movie that came out in 1977, in which the Imperials brought a ship that was much larger than the ship they were attacking. They always fight fair, those Imperials, and I imagine that's exactly what they stand for deep in their dark, sinister little hearts. Let's just move on to our next story. Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents Star Trek Conundrum. First Officer's Log. Stardate, NOV-1-00. The day was uneventful, except for a mishap in which the mess hall were Chief Engineer Kyle. Prologue. First Officer Sog, Stardate, NOV-1-00. The day was uneventful, except for a mishap in which the messel, where all the Chief of Scrutty Douglas Young to arrive. He arrives 2 days from now. In the meantime, I have kept myself busy, learning the habits of the new ship. I had learned that she likes a higher subatomic mix of endothermic crystals than specified, but is well within the Starfleet's regs. The usually new ship problems have cropped up even though we've already took her out for a test run a week ago. She seems to be putting up quite a fuss. All in all, a good crew so far, and a good ship. The captain also seems pleased with all shipboard happening so far. The station was busy. People from all kinds of ship were bustling about doing their various tasks with as many ships as people the Utopia Yard could get pretty busy. The captain looked worried as I looked up. "What's wrong?" I said, as she threw a data pod across the engine room at me. "Woo!" I said. I ducked the flinging projectile. "One of thought days, huh?" "Sorry, Ben," she said as she turned back to Ensign. "I don't care what data says. Make it happen." The ensign, looking sheepish, snapped to attention. "Yes, ma'am," he said, and then not wishing to beat her. "Yes, ma'am," he said. Then, not wishing to be beat, hurriedly went across the engine room, picked up the data pad, and left. Then the captain. "Look at everybody, Eels," in the engine room, and said, "What are you all looking at?" Immediately the work resumed. Forcing a fake smile, she looked at me and said, "Morning, Ben. Care to tell me while you are here talking to me when the Engris need to be aligned? Cargo B 2 needs to have gravity plates. Oh, wait. Cargo Bay 2 needs to have the gravity plates put in, and your caption needs to be committed. I'm here to make that last one not happen." "Thanks," she said, "but right now it would be a vacation." Started walking to the turbo lift. We get on inside, and she said, "Bridge!" We rode up in silence as we rode. I started to remember the file I had read on her. April Paris. Caption size 5'9", hair red, eyes green. It went on to talk about her history and where she grew up. She grew up on Earth, born and raised in San Diego. Her mother was a bartender. Her father left them when she was 16 years old. She going Starfleet at the first chance she got. She was a SPROT A student. She had a history of getting involved in fights, a noted temper that could very easily turn against you. Even now in the turbo lift, she seemed to be on the verge of throwing another data pad across the lift. She was deep in thought. Then out of the blue, she said, "Computer, halt turbo lift." I looked over at her just in time to meet a glare. I thought, great. What have I done now? She looked back at me and said without so much as twitch, "What are you going to do if there's a mutiny on board ship?" I looked stunted at her for a while and then said, "My place is with the captain. A lose." "Good," she said, "because I've got our first orders in. Already? We haven't even been putting all the gravity generators, and the oof still has bugs in it that need to be worked out." "I know," she cut in. "I don't like it either, but Starfleet Intel is saying that we need to go." "Well, great," I said sarcastically. She seemed to pick up on it. "Yeah, tell me about it. We need to be spaceworthy in 1 week." "1 week of it, crazy!" The second I finished the last word, I regretted saying it. She gave me a look of, "What, you can't handle it?" "Oh, great, I thought I've known her a whole 2 weeks, and she doesn't trust me, and she thinks I'm a wimp." "Great, just great." She let out a sigh, which I read as discomfort, and muttered for the turbo lift to continue. "Sorry," I said sheepishly. "I'm just getting used to the ship and her crew. I know what you mean, she said sympathetically. I'm still getting used to being called Captain. Every time someone yells, Captain on deck, I almost jump. Then I remember it's me they're talking about. She lets out another long sigh, smiling now. Well, well, about just have to make the best of it as we go. And with that, she stepped out onto the brig. Chapter 1. Core check complete. --- Full system checked. All systems are green. --- Power reading. 55.554% of optimal. --- Load personality. Main Alpha Zulu. I become aware of myself for the first time. It takes me a full 4.398 seconds to complete the 785,087,345,178 tasks that my main input had received. I cut the connection, and for the first time I have to think. I am a Bolo. My name is Unit of the Line of Danicombobre. I am part of the long and glorious tradition of war machines, the ancient restart. For some of the oldest war machines in the known universe, a tank. But I am more than the simpler ancestors that required a three-person crew to operate. I am a Bolo. I am a self-aware living capillary of thinking and reaction faster than any human could. And yet, I still have crew quota and a commander to bring, for the lack of a better word, the so-called human element of compassion, hope, feelings. Feelings I can never hope to understand reason with. I devote a subroutine to study emotions. As my viewing and optic centers start their flood of data, I can see for the first time I am housed in an underground base being operated by the Zerg. The Cavir is a mance to the humanoid life forms, slandered, but it barely contains Mias. I access my place memory files. I learn that I am 5 miles underneath the surface of Maldu. As I sift through my computer, Memorii Core, I learn why I have been built. To help the Zergs win the battle with the Dekkers. The battle has been fought for over 20 years. As I start to cycle through my movement functions, I discover restrictors on my key movement functions. This bothers me, for I am a fighting Metchin. Without movement, I cannot fight. Not that there is any enemy to engage. I am 5 miles underground. Krios. I sense a small tremor in the rock around the cavern. Intriguing. Well, all systems are functioning up to specs. Guess we can take off the restrictors now. No, not yet. We need to make sure that the thing doesn't go awol on us. It's not going to go awol, you know that. Yeah. That's what you said about the last one, and he went crazy. Yeah, I know. That's why we reprogrammed this one as a female, member. Please take cover under my treads. I watch in morbid fascination as the two technicians are crushed under the 56.457902 3-4 tons of rock have just been loused by the 89,067.653 megaton nuke hit 5 miles above us. From simply analysis, I finger out that the enemy knew about me and was trying to eliminate me before I could act on behalf of my creators. In a way, they were right. By the restrictors, I cannot move to start blast my way to the surface. I am taped. Chapter 2. Oh, I suppose that's it. Well, it's, interesting. The author, apparently has not found the time to be able to update his story, which he originally wrote in September of 2001. So, I imagine he'll get to chapter 2 of that story any minute now. I read it to completion, but something tells me this quite possibly cannot be the end. Let's move on to our next story. Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents Starlight Night by Sakura Lizelle. Starlight Night One-Shot. Disclaimers. As much as I may want to claim ownership of this production, I can't because Tensimuyo GXP belongs to a whole lot of different companies that I can't remember the names of at the moment. Any characters that appear in this fic that are not a part of the original series belong to me, so don't take them without asking first. Summary. Ryoko Seina pairing. Space pirate Ryoko Balta sat in her prison cell thinking about past events that led up to a meeting with the accident-prone Earthling who had unknowingly stolen her heart. Starlight Night, one shot by Sakura Ruzel. A lot of build-up to this. Space pirate Captain Ryoko Balta stared up at the stars lit up the night sky outside her galaxy police jail cell as she awaited the upcoming trial for her past crimes. She considered herself to be the greatest space pirate of her generation, maybe even right up there with the legendary space pirate who she was named after, who no one had seen in centuries. She was an orphan taken in by the leader of the space pirates, Daluma, and over the years worked her way up to being the most feared pirate captain in all the galaxies. She considered all the members of her crew her family and cared for each of them as they did her, though she made it a point to never show any weaknesses to her enemy that could get her killed. Okay. Yet in one day, her entire life came crashing down because of one human boy who she had always considered a nuisance in their short acquaintance with each other. But after a while, the boy had wound up worming his way into her heart. A year ago, she had gone undercover by enrolling herself in the Galaxy Police Academy, enrolling under the name Irma, while using a hologram projector wristwatch that gave her the appearance of an albino humanoid cat and voice synthesizer to change her voice so no one would know who she really was. Why did things have to turn out this way? It would have been so easy to simply shoot Seina and be done with the whole thing, Ryoko thought silently to herself as she sighed again unhappily, as tears slowly came to her eyes as she brushed them away against the back of her prison uniform in order to save my crew's families from Tauron's men. Now I'm probably going to have to wallow in prison for the rest of my life. A few days ago, she had been given an ultimatum by a fellow space pirate named Tauron Shanks that she, or at least her alter ego Irma, was to assassinate Seina Yamada, a young rookie galaxy police cadet from the planet who had been causing trouble for the space pirates lately. That resulted in a lot of pirate fleets getting caught or shipped off to jail. As Ryoko had learned through her disguise as Irma, she had discovered that Seina had a little problem that made him a living bad luck charm. Everywhere he went, something bad would happen. The fact that he had helped in the arrest of a lot of pirates had been a fluke thanks to his bad luck, and mostly her own fault, she guessed. The last time she encountered Seina as herself, she had her crew take the ship to warp drive to simply avoid him. She had been mad at him at the time. Yet, mere seconds later, Seina's own ship appeared right behind hers. She gave the order to make the warp jump again, thinking there was no way Seina would be able to find them again. She was wrong once more. For the next half hour, she had given orders to continue the warp jumps all over the galaxy to different locations all over the galaxy. Even going so far as to type in the coordinates herself, only to have Seina's police cruiser appear every time. Because apparently, Ryoko has never seen Droopy Dog or Bugs Bunny. The worst thing about the whole mess that she didn't discover until the final jump, as their actions had attracted a whole mess of space pirates and galaxy police officers who had picked up her signals the ship was giving off with each warp jump. And by the time the last jump happened, there were about 100 or so pirate ships tagging along just before the galaxy police showed up. Ryoko and her crew just barely managed to escape with their lives as shooting between the different groups started. By the end of the battle, half of the space pirate fleet had been nearly wiped out with the ships who hadn't fled the battle either destroyed and crews taken by the galaxy police and sent to prison. The Space Pirate High Council debated on what they were going to do about Seina, as they all decided he was a problem that needed to be eliminated before lost more pirates to the galaxy police because of mistakes like the last one. Somehow Tauron Shanks had known about Irma and told the High Council, telling them a story about how Irma was a spy in the galaxy police working for Ryoko, and recommended that Ryoko order Irma to kill Seina. Seina, I'm guessing. Ryoko had put up a huge argument over it, was overruled, and the order was put out. Tauron had a personal vendetta against Seina because one of his pirate ships had been taken into custody by the galaxy police had been captained by his father, and when he had went after Saina to personally avenge his father, had gotten his butt kicked by a young cadet in their first meeting. It wasn't until later that Ryoko had realized that she didn't have a choice as to whether or not she killed Saina, as she received news from her first mate that Tarrant Shanks had kidnapped the families of half her crew and were going to hold them hostage until he received word of Saina's demise, and her choice was made then and there. When she arrived back at the Galaxy Police Headquarters as Irma, she ran into Saina. Who had returned from a mission headquarters had sent them on. As he was heading around, and he was shopping around for stuff with his new paycheck, taking the opportunity to get him alone, she offered to help him with his shopping and showed him around all the different places and watched as he bought things for everyone at the academy. It was while they were shopping that she noticed that they were being tailed by two other girls named Amake and Kiriko, who had crushed on Saina, looking jealous as she shopped with them. So Ryoko took off with Saina in an attempt to get away from the other girls and took a secluded spot away from anyone who would see what she was going to do. As they relaxed in their new location, she started having second thoughts about killing Saina as he started talking about all the fun he'd been having since coming to space and joining the Galaxy Police. As he started rummaging through one of the shopping bags that they'd bought with him. But as she watched them, she happened to glance around and immediately noticed some men dressed as civilians who were trying to get out of sight while watching them. She recognized the men immediately from Tarrant's crew and knew that the jerk had sent them to spy on her to make sure she killed Saina. And she knew then that she had no other choice if her crew's family had a chance of surviving. She could feel tears starting to form in her eyes as she reached at her gun holster and started to pull out her plasma gun, planning to kill the teen quickly and cleanly before he even had the chance to know what happened, when he turned back to her holding a small jewelry bag in his hands, and his eyes widened in shock when he found her gun pointing his face. He stared up with her in disbelieving look on his face, and he asked why. With the tears running down her eyes, she tried to explain she was going to kill him, and she remembered how his face to soften up a bit. And he saw the tears running down her cheeks. Though he looked saddened as he knew his life was going to end now, he held out the jewelry bag to her, saying that he'd bought it from her in the marketplace and wanted to give it to her before he died. When she didn't immediately take the bag, Saina ripped open the bag himself and held it out to her to show a pair of earrings that she'd been admiring when she'd shown him around the different place to get him the things he'd wanted. When she asked him why he had bought them, he simply smiled at her and told her that he had seen how much she'd liked the earrings and had wanted to do something nice for her because of all her help that day. So he bought them for her as a thank you gift. Upon hearing his exclamation, caused her to break down as her gun fell from her limp hands. As she fell to the ground, as more tears flowed down her cheeks as she left, her Irma disguise melted away and revealed her true self to Saina, who had been shocked to see the real her. As he started to bend down and try to confront her, the two thugs came running towards with... Wow, that's a run-on! The two thugs came running forward with their guns drawn, intent on finishing the job and probably take Ryoko down with Saina. Saina. And he reached out to grab hold of Saina to push him behind her when a car came, driven by Amane and Kiriko, came crashing through the trees and sent the two thugs flying as the two girls leapt out of the car and rushed towards Saina while demanding to know if he was okay where Irma was, just as a few police cruisers. Just as a few police cruisers pulled up with their sirens blaring. As she was led away in handcuffs alongside Torrent's henchmen, the captain of the force, known as Iari, approached and gave her some good news. He just saved 15% on his auto insurance by switching to Geico. It turned out she was running around With Sina on their shopping spree, her crew had gotten themselves arrested while they were on the way to stop her from killing Sina because they had managed to rescue their families from the Tauren themselves while she was gone. While in police custody, they had told the police what was going to happen. The police had been lying in wait for her to make a move on Sina. Hearing the news that her crew and her families were safe brought some relief to her, as she realized she had completely betrayed her crew by not killing Sina as ordered. So she let herself be led away to the waiting cruiser. She heard Sina calling her name and begging the officers to wait a moment. Reluctantly, she turned back to face Sina, afraid to see the disappointment and possible hatred that he might have for her now. But instead, she saw relief in his eyes as he smiled at her. As he told her that he heard the news and congratulated her because her crew was safe before grabbing her handcuffed hands and placing the jewelry bag she left behind in her hands. When she tried to protest that she didn't deserve the earrings and that he'd brought them for Irma, Sheena shook his head while still smiling, as made her close her hand over the jewelry bag and pushed it to her, as he said he'd buy it for... Try that whole thing again. When she tried to protest that she didn't deserve the earrings, she had bought them for Irma, not to mention she probably couldn't have them in prison, Sheena shook his head. While still smiling, he made her close her hand over the jewelry bag and push it to her as he said that he had bought it for Irma, but since she was Irma, it was hers and he wanted her to keep it as a reminder. Ryoko smiled a bit at his words as she tightened her grip on the jewelry bag before she suddenly rushed towards Sina before the officers could react and placed a kiss on Sina's cheek as she whispered a thank you in his ear. Before she let the officers grab her arms and push her into the waiting cruiser. Oh god, if she'd have killed him at that point, that'd have been just the bee's knees. That had been over 2 weeks ago, and now Ryoko sat in her jail cell alone, possibly forgotten. She reached up with one hand to finger her earrings as they hung from her ears. Taking a lot of betting to get the guards to let her keep her earrings, and only after Iari had intervened that they had finally allowed her to keep them. As she continued to sit there by the barred window, she started to wonder to herself how things would be different if she pulled the trigger of her gun and killed Sina. She knew that the old her would probably have done it without hesitation or remorse if it meant protecting her crew, but the thought of doing it to Sina had made her blood run cold and stop herself from shooting him. Who am I kidding? If I could do the last couple of days all over again, I wouldn't change a thing, Ryoko thought silently to herself as she thought about the look of Sina's face as he smiled to her when he heard that her crew was okay. Though I wish I could have met Sina under different circumstances, maybe we could have been friends and something more. Pulling off her earrings, she laid down to the mattress. She stuck them all the way at the bottom of her pillowcase so that she'd know instantly where they were when she woke up in the morning and lay down on the cot as she drifted off to sleep with a smile on her face, and the earrings puncture her. The end. Oh, that's a question. The end. Author's note. So what do you guys think? Is it good or bad? Horrible flames won't be tolerated. The story, in and of itself, which certainly had a lot of build-up, had some of the most word-packed sentences I'd ever seen. Some of them even continued on to the next paragraph as there was no punctuation indicating the end of the sentence. Moving on, now with our final tale. You know, the term Mary Sue gets thrown around a lot in stories, and I would like to educate you through this program as to what exactly that means. In 1974, Paula Smith recognized a lot of fan fiction, which back then existed in fan magazines, as the internet had not yet been invented by Al Gore. She had seen that the authors of these stories had inserted characters that were not canon and seemed to be an extension of their own fantasies. Now, it is because of this that we recognize Paula Smith for her story, which appeared originally in the magazine The Menagerie in 1974. And I was able to find this on the internet, which is why I'm reading it, if you remember the first few episodes. And it is called A Trekkie's Tale. Enjoy. Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents A Trekkie's Tale by Paula Smith. Gee, golly gosh, Glorioski, thought Mary Sue as she stepped onto the bridge of the Enterprise. Here I am, the youngest lieutenant in the fleet, only 15 and a half years old. Captain Kirk came up to her. Oh, Lieutenant, I love you madly. Will you come to bed with me? Captain, I'm not that kind of girl. You're right, and I respect you for it. Here, take over the ship for a minute while I go get some coffee for us. Mr. Spock came onto the bridge. What are you doing in the command seat, Lieutenant? The captain told me so. Flawlessly logical. I admire your mind. Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, Dr. McCoy, and Mr. Scott beamed down with Lieutenant Mary Sue to Rigel 37. They were attacked by green androids and thrown into prison. In a moment of weakness, Lieutenant Mary Sue revealed to Mr. Spock that she, too, was half-Vulcan. Recovering quickly, she sprung the lock with her hairpin. All got away back to the ship. Back on board, Dr. McCoy and Lieutenant Mary Sue found out the men beamed down were seriously stricken. Jumping cold Robbies, Mary Sue less so. While the four officers languished in sickbay, Lieutenant Mary Sue ran the ship, and ran it so well she received the Nobel Peace Prize, the Vulcan Order of Gallantry, and the Tralfamandorian Order of Good Guyhood. However, the disease quickly got to her, and she fell fatally ill in the sickbay. She breathed her last. Surrounded by Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, Dr. McCoy, and Mr. Scott, all weeping unashamedly at the loss of her beautiful youth and youthful beauty, intelligence, capability, and all-around niceness. Even to this day, her birthday is a national holiday of the Enterprise. The end. Concludes this episode of Pretentious Internet Theater. Just a reminder, you can email us at pretentiousinternettheater@gmail.com. Also, be sure to go to MegaCon, located in Orlando, Florida, at the Orange County Convention Center, Hall D. We will be having a panel Sunday, March 14th, in room W224 FTHI. It's the main events room, immediately following the anime music video competition and the results of the Pocky Photo Patrol. Whose brilliant idea was this? It's only because it is sponsored by the Gilligo Corporation that will allow this oversight to happen. So immediately following the results of the Pocky Photo Patrol, which happens immediately following the anime music video competition, you can attend a live reading of Quentin Tarantino's Run the One Half, presented by Pretentious Internet Theater. Remember, there is much drama on the internet. Only the best makes pretentious internet. Good night. Pleasure.